Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In February this year, the 12,000-pound killer whale Telecom killed his trainer, Don Brancho, at a show at SeaWorld in Orlando. Outside Magazine's Tim Zimmerman has gone deep on this killer whale and the whole disturbing history of killer whales in captivity to help us understand what happened. It's an unsettling story of nature and a top predator meeting the multi-billion dollar entertainment industry of the capture, breeding, and training of killer whales. This hour on Point, the incredible story behind a trainer's death at SeaWorld. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the killer whales surging in their tanks? Have you thought what might make one kill? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And behind me, you can hear the sound of wild orcas collected by Howard Garrett at the Orca Network in Washington State. Quite a sound and quite a species. Huge. And in this case, wild, but not in those tanks. Joining me now from Washington is Tim Zimmerman, correspondent for Outside Magazine. His article in the July issue is titled, "The Killer in the Pool." Tim, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here with you, Tom.
I know this is not exactly the way you describe it, but here from February 24th is from a CBS News report, the day Telecom attacked Don Brancho at SeaWorld in Orlando. This is an unidentified witness describing what she saw.
She was standing on the rock right above the viewing area. He jumped out. He took off, and then he came back. He jumped off, grabbed her, started thrashing around, and then her shoe fell off. I mean, he was thrashing her around pretty good. It was violent.
She ended up dead that day. There are many ways that witnesses see what happens at an event. You've talked with a lot of people, Tim Zimmerman, and come back with an incredible story, not just of that day, but of this magnificent species and this enormous chunk of the entertainment industry that killer whales, in effect, underwrite. Take us back to that day for beginners. We're going to go much, much wider to Iceland and beyond here, but take us back to that day at that SeaWorld, and from your reporting, what happened, Tim?
Well, what happened was that Don Brancho, who was a very experienced and senior trainer with SeaWorld, was doing a show with Tillicum called Dine with Shamu, in which visitors to SeaWorld eat lunch at an open cafe around one of their pools. And Don takes Tillicum through a variety of behaviors so they can see a killer whale up close. At the end of the show, the visitors normally go down to an underwater viewing area, mm-hmm. and the show pauses while the visitors go down there to take pictures. And normally Don would send the killer whale, in this case Tillicum, with a signal to go down to the underwater viewing area so they could take pictures of him close up. As she lay with him and worked with him on a ledge in some shallow water, she lay down next to him.
So she's on the ledge, shallow water. He's in the big pool. He's too big to be there, but they're right next to one another.
They're right next to one another, and she's conducting what SeaWorld calls a relationship session. The killer whales need all kinds of stimulation and interactivity to thrive. Mm-hmm. And following the show, she was working with him in that way. She was preparing to send him down to the window when all of a sudden witnesses saw him grab her and pull her into the pool.
Now, reading your article here, before that happened, she's lying there. She's got her hair. She's blonde, 40-year-old, vivacious. But she's got her hair in a ponytail, but it's kind of fanned out in that shallow ledge water.
Yes. Dawn was an incredible person from what I was told, and friends of hers told me that she was growing her hair long, as she often did, to donate it to cancer victims. Mm-hmm. And in this case, SeaWorld had a policy where you had to keep hair in a ponytail, and Dawn had hers in a ponytail, but the trainer who was spotting for her saw her hair, her ponytail, drifting in the water, and saw it touch or brush against Tillicum's nose. And at that point, he grabbed the hair, according to this spotter. And when Don tried to tug it back, all of a sudden you were in a tug-of-war, which is stimulating for a killer whale, and a tug-of-war that he was bound to win. And he pulled her into the pool. And then, as your witness on CBS described, mm-hmm. his behavior became very violent. And it was really no match, and it's believed that she died very quickly.
They hit the siren, a sort of emergency siren there, gave all kinds of signals for him to back off, get out of there. Nothing worked.
Yeah, SeaWorld is very careful. I mean, they understand that these are wild animals. They train and they have procedures for when killer whales break from the training or break from the routines and get into incidents or into attacks on trainers. And they have a whole series of things that they try to do. But in this case, nothing really worked. And in some people even suspect, or some former trainers suspect, that the actual procedures themselves only made him more excited with all the noise, nets coming into the water, and the like.
Don Branshaw was 123 pounds. He was 12,000 pounds. She tried to, the reports say she managed to break free and swim toward the surface, but he got her, took her down again. And as you say, before it was over, she was dead. The country's kind of stunned by this. And what you share with us, it's an incredible piece of work in Outside Magazine. There's a link to it on our website, but I recommend it. This is just a tremendous piece of reporting here. You describe this as in a way, a kind of outcome of decades of a history of killer whales being captured in ways I had never heard about and brought in enormous creatures into these quite tight confinements, given what they do in the wild.
Yeah, I mean, when I heard about the death of Don Branshaw, and then I heard that Tillicum had been involved in previous deaths, I became very interested in trying to understand his life experience, to try to understand what might have happened and what prompted him to either kill previously or to kill Don. And once I started looking into that, I was pulled into this whole history of killer whale entertainment. And Tillicum became a very, very interesting protagonist in the story because his lifespan basically spans the entire life of this industry. He was one of the he was a killer whale that was captured in the early cowboy days, where killer whales were captured from the wild and brought to marine parks. But he also became prominent after marine parks started to move to captive births and ended the wild captures, mm-hmm. because he became such a prominent breeder for them. So the more I learned and the more I talked to people, the more fascinating the story became, and Tillicum and his life story just pulled me in.
We want to hear that story. We've got callers. It looks like we may have one here who was there that day at SeaWorld, Suzanne in Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. Suzanne, you're on the air. Were you really there?
Yeah, Tom, I was.
What happened? What did you see?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Tim, that his article is excellent. He did a good research on it, and we were at the Dine with Shamu. The show had ended. They made, you know, the announcement to please leave, blah, blah, blah. The show has ended. We had taken my son there for his 10th birthday. It was a surprise gift, and we were sitting right up front, and so everybody had pretty much filed out of that area, and we decided to stick around because we were filming, you know, the inside of the little restaurant and the signs.
Yep.
And Dawn was still interacting with him. She had gone out on the side ledge, you know, like a little dock that's covered with like 3 inches of water.
Mm-hmm.
So we were still filming her. And, so the only people left in there were the employees cleaning up. The trainer, Jan, because the other trainer involved with the show had gone downstairs, which was Lynn, and we filmed. You probably saw the film on TV. Everything they used was our film footage. We shot right up until probably 10 seconds before he pulled her in. If you froze the last shot, it shows her face smiling, laying next to him.
And in she went. What did you see once she was pulled into the water, Suzanne?
I thought it looked at first from where we were, I was probably 30 feet away from her, that her ponytail, I don't know whether he grabbed it or it went into his mouth, but, I mean, you know, the other witness that I just listened to, that he came up and grabbed her, that didn't happen. She was laying next to him, rubbing him
right
in the hair. He grabbed her and he kind of rolled, I mean, a very hard thrust. She went over his back and he pulled her down with such a force. And it happened within a matter of seconds, and I screamed to the trainer. So I kind of disagree with what he has been saying all along, because I yelled to him twice. He just took her down. He took her down. He got up. He kind of slipped. He ran. He had his little yellow box, which I guess if you put near the water, it makes a sound, and it's supposed to
call him off
the whale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he started banging the water with an oar. And then he ran out back and sounded the alarm. So she was already in the water a good minute to a minute and a half before he sounded the alarm, unlike what was said that he sounded it immediately.
And things got worse from there. You know, Tim Zimmerman, as you're listening to this, we're all listening. I mean, you quote people in the article saying these whales are highly intelligent killer whales. They're at the top of the dolphin family. And that killer whales know exactly what they're doing when they've got something or someone like Don Branshaw in their grip, Tim.
Well, this was a question that fascinated me. This question is, are they intelligent enough to know what they're doing? And one of the things I was surprised to learn, not having followed this whole industry before, was that these sorts of incidents or aggression or attacks on trainers happen quite frequently. However, this was the first time that a SeaWorld trainer was ever killed, and so there was something different about this incident. And so it seemed clear to me that in some cases, either the killer whales back off, or maybe they know when they're about to cross that threshold where a trainer will be killed. And so I wanted to look into that, and I talked to a previous trainer who had, in 1987 in San Diego, been attacked by two killer whales. And it was fascinating because he described to me that he could tell that one killer whale was very angry and the other was just playing.
Mm-hmm.
And these killer whales took him down to the bottom of the pool five times. And each time he told me, just as he felt he was about to black out or run out of breath, they took him to the surface. And he believes that they have some sense of how far to push and how far to go.
I mean, it's the way they live, under and then surface, under and surface. It's part of their own natural movement in the water.
That's right. And then he said that if they had taken him down a sixth time, he would have died, he was sure. But for whatever reason, they gave up at that point and let him go. So there are those who work with him who believe that there's an awareness that they have about what they're doing.
The sound there of orcas, killer whales, in the wild. We're talking today about the inside story of the killer whale that killed at SeaWorld and the disturbing reality of killer whales in captivity, as reported by Tim Zimmerman in the July issue of Outside Magazine. He's gone very deep on the whole business of killer whales in captivity and on this death, this killing in particular. Tim Zimmerman joins us today from Washington. His article is The Killer in the Pool. Tim, take us right back to the sort of beginning of the marine park business. You go all the way back to the 1960s, how they were captured, how they were kept, and how this particular killer whale, Telecom, figures into this story.
Well, what was interesting is that in the 60s or before the mid-60s, no one ever really thought about keeping killer whales in marine parks or in aquariums. But there was a kind of a visionary at Seattle Public Aquarium named Ted Griffin, who dreamed of keeping a killer whale. He heard of a killer whale that had been snagged in some fishermen's nets up in British Columbia, and he went up and purchased it. He called it Namu because the town where the killer whale was captured was Namu.
Mm-hmm.
And he towed the killer whale all the way back to Seattle, 450 miles, in a kind of pen that he and his partner Don Goldsberry built, with the killer whale's family pod following most of the way with the captured whale.
And you remind us that these are creatures that stay in family units, large ones, for life. They're very tight-knit families.
Yes, they live very, very highly complex social lives, all based around family and matriarchs. And at the time that Ted Griffin brought Namu to the Seattle Public Aquarium, the public view of killer whales was that they were dangerous. Fishermen regularly shot at them whenever they saw them near their nets. The U.S. military often strafed them for target practice. And Ted Griffin brought this killer whale to Seattle and discovered it was highly intelligent, very gentle, and was very quickly riding it. And this became a national sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you could see the potential for entertainment. Ted and his partner, Don Goldsberry, went out and caught a second killer whale. And that whale they called Shamu for Namu,
mm-hmm.
And that's the whale that SeaWorld, which was a growing park at the time in San Diego, eventually bought from them, and that became the first Shamu.
$70,000 for the $70,000 for that, and you say that the beginning right there of a $1 billion franchise.
That's right. I mean, SeaWorld was recently sold to the Blackstone Group, and it's a number of parks plus the marine parks. It was sold for $2.7 billion.
This is a big New York private investment company.
That's right, a private equity firm. Mm-hmm. And SeaWorld, I think, in their three parks, has about 12 million visitors per year, spending probably on an average of $50 to $100 a piece. So it is huge business. And one thing that's interesting is that because these captures began and because SeaWorld and others began to display the killer whales, the world discovered that they were fascinating and compelling creatures. I talked to Don Goldsberry, who was basically a fisherman who was intrigued by the challenge of trying to capture killer whales. And he figured out how to do it. He figured out how to transport them in airplanes. He figured out how to do all of that. Unfortunately, obviously, when you're going in and you're rounding up pods of killer whales, the method they used was to try to spot the pods of families traveling together. They would use boats and what are called seal bombs, or explosives, mm-hmm. that fishermen use to keep seals away from their catch.
To herd them round into coves and round them up there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And then they would select out the younger females normally because they were smaller. And that could be a very obviously stressful and violent process for the killer whales. And so over the course of the years where they were doing this in the Pacific Northwest, they captured or trapped hundreds of whales, and they eventually sold some 50-plus to marine parks. They also killed, inadvertently, unintentionally, but nevertheless killed, about 9 killer whales.
Which in the 1970s got them banned, really, from doing it around Washington State and sent them off to Iceland, where Telecom comes in.
That's exactly right. I mean, eventually, protests started over these captures. In particular, in 1 year, in 1970, they rounded up the entire resident population of killer whales in one cove in this town and spent a few days pulling out a number of killer whales. And the townspeople were in agony because there were sounds of the killer whale shrieking and mm-hmm. calling. And so that did force them out of the state of Washington, because the captures were regulated, but they were supposed to be humane. And so Don Goldsberry, who became a lead collector for SeaWorld, flew around the world and settled on Iceland and set up an infrastructure in Iceland to capture and transport killer whales. And that's where Telecom was caught in 1983.
Well, I wish we could get every detail. We won't be lucky enough, but Telecom ends up in a show and in very tight quarters with two dominant females who are kind of the top of the pecking order there, and in a tank that's called the Module, which sounds almost like a sensory deprivation tank, Tim.
Yes. I mean, so Telecom's first stop was in a very basic marine park that was in a marina. It was like a sideshow in a marina that was up in Victoria, Canada. And he was put in, as you say, with two females. And killer whales, as we mentioned, are a matriarchal society, and the females basically run the show. But when you put random killer whales together in a marine park, there's no real process to establish who's going to be the dominant female other than some fighting. And so young Telecom was put in the midst of these two females who were fighting, and they tended to pick on him regardless. And then at night, because the owner of Sealand was worried that activists would either cut the net in the marina to let the whales escape or they would get out themselves, they would move the three whales into this very small pool that was called the Module. And it was sensory deprivation in a way. It was a metal-sided tank. It was barely bigger in diameter than the whales were. And they would leave it in the dark, and the whales would sit there for 14 and a half hours till the staff came the next day.
You write later on in your article about Ken Balcom, who follows wild orcas off of Washington State, and we'll talk with him later in the hour, but he said that after everything he's been through over all these years, Telecom is, this is the same whale who killed Don Brancho. He called him basically psychotic.
Well, that's the case. I mean, if you look at the behavior of Telecom, particularly when a human being falls in the water with his tank, he does exhibit what we would consider psychotic behavior. He's very violent. He's very possessive. And what happened in Sealand was that a trainer, a part-time trainer, slipped and fell in the water. And these killer whales had never been trained, as they train killer whales at SeaWorld, to accept humans in the water, to mm-hmm. work with them and to ignore them, because it was viewed as risky to do that. And so as soon as this part-time trainer fell in the water, or fell halfway in the water, one of the killer whales grabbed her and pulled her all the way in. And then all three killer whales treated her like any other toy or object that fell in their tank. And being bored by their existence, I think, they started to play with her. And that killed her. In subsequent incidents, Telecom in 1999, a young guy climbed into the tank overnight. He snuck into SeaWorld's mm-hmm. park in Orlando, and he thought he would go swimming with a killer whale, and he had the very bad luck to choose the tank that Telecom was in, and the same behavior repeated itself.
The next morning they found him draped over Telecom's back, sort of naked, dead.
That's right. I mean, so it's clear that Telecom in particular, his experience has led him to treat humans in the water in a very particular way. And SeaWorld had this, when the Sealand shut down after this incident where this trainer had been killed and sold its killer whales to SeaWorld, And SeaWorld had the same dilemma. How do they make Tillicum more safe? Can they train him to accept humans in the water, to work with him in the water? And they were confident that they knew how to do that, but they also realized that if anything went wrong, the liability issues would be enormous. And so Tillicum, unlike most of the other SeaWorld killer whales, or all of them, was never trained to either be desensitized to humans in the water or to work with humans in the water. So if someone's in the water with him, it's a very, very dangerous situation.
Tim, we've got a call coming in from one of the trainers who actually I think you spoke to for this article, calling from DeLand, Florida. John, is this John Jett?
Yeah, I'm on the phone.
Hi, John. You're on the air. We saw you quoted in Tim's article here. He describes a Tillicum as having become pretty dangerous, but you worked very closely with this creature. How did you see this killer whale?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call, and I'd just like to say that I really applaud Tim Zimmerman's benchmark article. His work really represents one of the first to present this rather ugly side of an industry, which those in the industry, frankly, would rather keep hidden, so he is to be complimented for his work. And, yes, sir, you are correct. I work with Tillicum pretty extensively from the early to mid-1990s. And Tillicum was a lot of fun to work with. You know, we knew sort of vaguely of his history, although the details were never really presented to us with much clarity.
Did you know that two people had died in the tank with Tillicum?
Well, at the time I was working with Tillicum, only one person
okay.
had been killed at,
okay.
at that time. I left before the second victim.
Were you in the tank with him? Were you? This was the days when you, I don't know, did you ride around with him, jump around with him, or what?
No. There was some safety protocol put in place, one of which was pretty loud and clear that, you know, you couldn't enter the water with this animal. And other safety protocol, which, by the way, there were, you know, really very few regulations for the trainers. Another one was that you had to have a senior person spotting a particular session with Tillicum. But no, we weren't allowed to get into the water with him. So I thankfully never entered the water with Tillicum.
Did you think that these creatures were suffering when you were working with them, John?
Well, you know, I have some observations that may be pertinent to the discussion. You know, Tim mentions that Tillicum was often the, bore the brunt of aggression. And me, working with the animals day in and day out, I would often watch as whales such as Tillicum, and we had a now-deceased little female named Winnie. They were regularly the target of serious aggression from the much more dominant females such as Katina and Gudrun in the captive population. So let's take Tillicum, for example. Tillicum is much larger than the smaller and more agile and dominant females
mm-hmm.
that he is in the pools with. And so as a result, Tillicum's large size and the relatively small pools that he lives in sometimes results in situations where he simply cannot get away from the aggression. And so for me, day in and day out watching this, I found this to be extremely disconcerting, especially in their small pools where there's really no place to run, and Tillicum was regularly the focus of hostile females. So, you know, sort of along mm-hmm. these lines, there were times when the whales would bleed from cuts and rakes so badly that we would end up having to move whales out of the sight of the public. In fact, I coined the term skywriting, which Tim mentions in his article, to describe the stream of blood left in the water as whales would swim through the column of water.
Were you shocked? Were you surprised when Dawn was killed?
I have to say I was not. In fact, when Tillicum claimed his second victim, I remember turning to a friend and saying, somebody else will be killed before it's all over, and I suspected it would be a trainer. You work very closely in very close proximity with the animals on a regular basis, and by the way, the trainers, I think, provide excellent care for the animals. They do the best they can given the situation. And it's human nature to eventually let your guard down. I know I did it, too many times to count. I probably could have been snagged by Tillicum too many times to count. But I was not at all surprised, unfortunately.
John Jett, former trainer at SeaWorld, I appreciate your calling in. I want to get with us right now here Thad Lasinic. He spent 35 years at Busch Entertainment Corporation, left there as vice president and corporate curator of Animal Trainer. He directed animal training at all U.S. SeaWorld and Busch Gardens theme parks. He's founder now of Precision Behavior. They do professional education programs for domestic and wild animals. He's author of Whale Done Parenting and Whale Done. Thad joins us from Orlando. Thad Lasinic, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. Tim Zimmerman reminds us millions of Americans have seen these magnificent creatures, been thrilled by them. Nobody, of course, thrilled when we get into a situation like you saw with Don Branshaw. And, you know, lots of questions that come up in Tim Zimmerman's article about whether or not such enormous, intelligent creatures can be, what's the word, humanely, appropriately kept in captivity. How do you look at this report, Thad?
Well, I retired from SeaWorld 2 years ago, so I have nothing to gain by defending SeaWorld, but I would like to correct a few things that have been said in the article. Number one, I'd like to address the gentleman you just had on, John Jett. It would be nice if we would have looked into their backgrounds a little bit more before we take everything that they say as being true. John Jett was never even made it to trainer level. He was an associate trainer while he was at SeaWorld. In fact, he was going to be moved to another area, and that's probably why he quit, because he was not cutting it at the Shamu Stadium. He was not up to par with the other trainers.
But the thing he says that he feared would eventually happen, Thad, did happen. You did eventually have this death.
Yeah, and again, these are very, very dangerous animals. They are animals that we work with and that Don knew and was very aware of the issues working with killer whales. They have the name killer whale. It's not like we didn't know that they were capable of these things and that the trainers don't know.
Though in the wild, they don't kill humans. Can you keep them humanely? Can you keep them in a way that matches their size and their intelligence without being cruel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for Ken Baucom to state that the animal's psychotic, last time I checked, he did not have a psychology degree to make that statement. In fact, I'm a little surprised at Ken's statements a few times. I've met with Ken and sat down with Ken on his porch up in Puget Sound also, and I've talked to him many times. And for Ken as a scientist to make some of the statements that Tim put in the magazine article is ridiculous.
Do you think we'll see more deaths like this? Is there just a problem that can't be solved here, Thad?
No, we're not going to see more deaths like this. I mean, SeaWorld's going to address this. They're addressing it right now. The trainers are not in the water until they address all the safety concerns. And contrary to what was said a little while ago, there are safety protocols, and there were safety protocols in place when Dawn had her ponytail grabbed. She made a split-second bad decision, allowing her ponytail to drift into the water. And Tillicum played with her and grabbed a hold of it. Yes, it did eventually get aggressive because Tillicum did not want to give her up. And he wanted to play with her. And yes, as the article says, we did not do water work with Tillicum because of the liability issues.
Water work, is humans in the tank with him.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the reason we decided that was because it was decided that it would be too much of a risk to train him for that after he had already killed somebody.
Will he still perform for audiences at SeaWorld, or are his performing days done?
I don't know if he will perform again or not. That's going to be up to SeaWorld. Like I said, I don't work there anymore. I retired from SeaWorld 2 years ago in 2008.
Would you put him in performance again?
Under certain circumstances, yes. I would see no reason not to put him in. I disagree with all the statements about him being psychotic or having issues like that. Yes, he is a very dangerous animal with people in the water. So you have to put in precautions and you have to put things in perspective, though.
That last Nick, I'm afraid we're out of time right there, but I appreciate your being with us today. For 35 years at Busch Entertainment Corporation, he was in charge of all animal training at U.S. SeaWorld and Busch Gardens theme parks. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the inside story of the killer whale that killed at SeaWorld in February and looking at the broader picture of this tremendous top predator of the seas in captivity, nature meeting the tank here. Tim Zimmerman is with us. He's written a terrific story for Outside Magazine of all the background of the industry and this particular incident where Don Branshaw died in February, as the whole world knows, at SeaWorld in Orlando. People have been sympathetic for a long time to these great creatures in captivity. 1993 hit movie Free Willy, all about a boy who frees a killer whale from a local theme park. Here's a little bit of tape from that show when Willy first arrives. That is, the orca. The park's trainer, Lori Petty, is unhappy with her boss's decision to buy and feature the killer whale as the star attraction.
The examination area is completely inadequate.
But it's all we've got.
Holding him in this net is dangerous. We've told you that I don't know how many times.
Could you finish the exam now?
No, he's acting up too much.
You and Dial bought Willie from some slime ball whale catcher. He was too big and too old to be caught in the first place. Then you put him in a dolphin tank alone. He's not a natural performer, and you expect me to work miracles?
Free Willy in 1993, and the story goes on. Tim Zimmerman is with us from Outside Magazine. Tim, we just heard there from Thad Lasinic, who for many, many years was in charge of animal training at SeaWorld Parks. And you heard him say, you know, he doesn't think that this is cruel. He thinks that they've got, you know, lots of good procedures in effect. For that matter, he's not even sure that telecom shouldn't perform again. What are you thinking as you hear that perspective, Tim?
Well, I mean, I think that that there are three issues that SeaWorld needs to, or we all need to understand, to try to understand whether this is a humane way to keep killer whales. And I should preface it by saying that I think that SeaWorld is incredibly sophisticated and sincere in its efforts to make life in marine parks as humane and healthy for killer whales as possible. But there's just a certain reality of what life in a marine park is for a killer whale versus life in the wild. And what stuck out to me when I looked into this whole question is that there are three things that go on in marine parks that don't seem to go on in the wild, and which get to this question of, is it humane and mm-hmm. should it be done? The first is, you know, there are attacks on humans in the marine parks, on the trainers. There are dozens and dozens of serious incidents where trainers have been injured severely, put in wheelchairs, almost killed. And as far as we know, there are no reported such behaviors in the wild. The killer whales do not tend to attack humans in the wild. The second is that there's a lot of aggression between killer whales at marine parks. And within a family pod in the wild, as Ken can describe, it just rarely ever goes on. But it's clear, and it's become even more clear to me since I've done the article, that managing the social interaction of these whales is very, very complex and difficult. And there are often severe injuries as one whale and another get into aggressions with each other, sometimes to the point, as John mentioned, that whales can be held out of a show, and also sometimes to the point where one killer whale is moved from one theme park to another simply because the social situation in the theme park's no good. Mm-hmm. And then just the last thing, which is a critical question, which gets right to the heart of sort of whether this is a humane thing, is that killer whales in the wild, females live to a median age of about 50 and can be 80 or 90 years old.
Mm-hmm.
At the extreme, males can live to 30 and be 50 or 60 years. In the marine parks, they die much younger. It's very rare for killer whales, and Tilikum is actually one of the oldest whales in marine captivity, mm-hmm. and he's about to approach 30. Mm-hmm. And so you have to ask why that is. There's some sort of underlying stress. There's something happening in the marine parks that affects their mortality. And so those are all the issues that you have to address. I mean, there's passionate believers on both sides of this issue as to whether it's humane or not. What I really just tried to do is get as much of the facts out there in front of readers and let them make up their own mind about
it. A long trip for Tilikum from off the shores of Iceland to SeaWorld in Orlando via lots of stops along the way. Tom in Brighton, you're on the air, Tom.
I wanted to just bring up a point which is certainly underlying everything that's being said, but I'm just going to articulate it, hopefully.
Okay.
And that is, can animals do something that's purely malicious or psychotic, whatever you want to call it? And I feel like it's I'm an animal lover, and it's the basic questions we have towards animals is, are they innocent? I guess that's my question. I'll take it off the air.
That's interesting, wide, but it goes right to kind of the heart of things. What do you think, Tim? Can we really have a sense of what's going on? Are these just killer whales playing with an interesting object? Or what about the notion of maliciousness here?
Well, I think that is the question I tried to answer. Could a killer whale choose to kill? And not surprisingly, I came up with different answers. But I think that with Tilikum in particular, there's a video, an underwater camera that took basically video of what he was doing in the water with Dawn. That video, for good reasons, probably has not been made public. But it shows very, very violent interaction that I think anyone who actually saw it would be hard-pressed to say he's playing with her. There are incidents, as the trainer I talked to who was injured in 1987 mentioned, where he thought one whale was playing with him and another was not. So I think there's something definitely intentional about how the killer whales are interacting with trainers, and when you get these aggressions, there's something intentional about them. Whether they're malicious or not is just a question I simply think we'll never be able to answer until we can talk to the killer whales.
Let's go to Steve in Terreville, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Great show. What I was wondering was, what's the ratio of attacks between male and female killer whales? And also, might the aggression be a result of taking them out of such a highly social situation in the pods and create that aggression because their hierarchy has been disturbed?
Yeah, those are great questions. Gender and social disruption. Thanks, Steve. Tim?
It is a great question, and it's hard to know the answer about the specific ratio simply because, you know, these incidents don't always get reported. SeaWorld probably would have a good answer in terms of, you know, the incidence of females and males. And the other element that's interesting also is there are two types of killer whales, or there are many types, but there's a resident type which stays in one area generally and tends to eat fish. And then there's a transient type, which is more used to traveling long distances and eating marine mammals. And so I wondered whether a transient might be more likely to be aggressive or to attack mm-hmm. a human because a human is more like their prey. But I think it turns out that there really doesn't seem to be a rhyme or a reason in particular. And there could be so many reasons that a killer whale on any given day decides to attack a trainer. I mean, it could be this social bad night in the tanks where there's aggression and they're feeling frustrated. It could be captivity and just sort of the feeling of confinement and the artificial sounds they're hearing. It could be their hormonal cycling. So I don't know. I mean, that I think SeaWorld probably knows more than anyone about, you know, why a killer whale might or what provokes an incident. But so far, they're not saying.
Let's go to Julie in Arlington, Massachusetts. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to commend Tim. This is a very long overdue article. 25 years ago, I worked with the group No Jails for Whales in Tulsa to protest whales and dolphins about an aquarium they were trying to bring in back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Rico Berry, the former trainer of Flipper, also come. It's really the whole thing to animals. I'm very sympathetic and feel horrible about the woman who lost her life. But until a human is injured, nobody pays attention to what the real cost of having wildlife in captivity is.
Julie, I'm sorry, your line is just breaking up a little too much on us, and I'm sorry for that. But we got the idea, protesting with No Jails for Whales years ago and still seeing it as just wrong, whether or not a human loses a life. Let me put against that, and I appreciate your call, Julie, but here we've got a web comment, Tim, from Commenter Margot. She says, what I want to know after hearing all the animal rights activists' complaints is simple. What scientific evidence is there, she writes, that these animals are suffering in captivity? Not assumptions because of their intelligence, size, social habits, but actual scientific data. How does a wild orca show that it's stressed? What do you say to that, Tim?
Well, I mean, I think it'd be a challenge to design the scientific experiment that would prove that. But what I say to that is there are many manifestations or indications that that they're stressed, particularly the early death situation. There has to be a reason why their immune systems become compromised and they're susceptible to pneumonia and other infections. And I think that stress is a big part of that. And I think also if you just, you know, if Margot spent time in the back pools of marine parks, probably, you know, she would see some of the aggressions that John Jett referred to. And she might then get a sense of, well, maybe this isn't the most natural environment for them to be in. I do think that there's a broader question raised by this whole story, which everyone is really considering in the background here, which is, you know, how humans relate to other species and animals, particularly intelligent ones. And Jean-Michel Cousteau said something very important, I think, that I quoted in the article, which is that he wondered whether the benefits of captivity have really expired now. I mean, I do think that SeaWorld transformed killer whales into an iconic animal. And if they're ever threatened in the wild, and there are reasons that their populations in the wild are coming under stress, you know that people would care about them. And I think that's largely to the credit of SeaWorld. SeaWorld also taught the world a lot about gestation and the birth process. But you have to ask the question now, as you look at the situation the killer whales are in, and you come to your own conclusions about whether it's humane or not, whether there's any more benefit other than entertainment and profit to be gained by keeping them in captivity.
You shared some thoughts with us from Jeff Venter, who you also quote, I guess another former trainer here who's now a doctor, medical doctor, and who pointed out issues that he sees with captivity, chronic tooth decay as a result of steel gates and breaking their teeth on gates, jaw popping at each other, retinal damage from looking up in that training environment. They have to look up to see their trainers a lot. Retinal damage, he says, from the sun. Collapsed dorsal fins. This is interesting because in the wild you see them absolutely vertical, but a lot of them are sort of off at an angle among captive orcas, or maybe even deformed. Forced social reorganization. As you write, they live together for life in the wild and very committed in those pods, broken up. And finally, he says, I don't know right or wrong, but we heard the pushback here from Thad Lasnik, but pathological behaviors as a consequence of living in a blue box. He writes, orcas do not kill humans in the wild. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from San Juan Island, right up in the northwest corner of the country, Washington State. Ken Balcom is here, founder and senior scientist at the Center for Whale Research. Spent more than three decades conducting a census of the killer whale population in the inland waters of Washington State and lower British Columbia. Ken Balcom, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Thad Lasnik is pretty emphatic in saying that nobody can say that Tillicum is psychotic, and he challenges that characterization. How do you come to it?
Well, his behavior is certainly quite different from anything we see naturally in the environment here. We just don't have that type of aggression toward all the thousands of people that are watching these whales here daily.
And there it was at SeaWorld. What did the collection of killer whales from your area do to the whale population there over the decades since it started up in the 60s, Ken?
Well, as was pointed out, about 50 were removed for the display industry, and we had about 70 left when that removal was stopped due to the capture that you referred to, where all of them were taken in Penn Cove.
So that's not half, but it's a huge chunk of what the wild population was there. Will it eventually recover, do you think, to its former level?
The population did recover. It was recovering until the mid-80s. Then there was a slight depression because a lot of the young whales had been taken out that would have matured and had babies. And then it started climbing again to almost 100. I was hopeful that it would reach the pre-capture number of probably 120. But we've had some other issues, ecological fish depletion and so on.
People love to see these enormous, magnificent creatures perform. Millions and millions, 12 million maybe have done it, and these shows are not cheap. What do you think about the whole business of performing killer whales? Can it be done humanely or not, in your view, Ken?
Well, it's an entertainment industry, and I agree that SeaWorld is the best in the business. They do take great care of their animals. They've got very gifted trainers, and they've got an advertising network that's phenomenal. But that, to me, does not replace what's in the wild, the natural. If I were a lion trainer, I would want to go see lions in their natural habitat to understand and know them better. They're magnificent in the wild.
What about the scores who are in those performance tanks now? I mean, if you were, king of the mountain, would you flip the switch, open the gate, and let them go back to sea?
Oh, no, I don't think that's possible. We've got so much mix and match in terms of the genetic structure of the captive population. Most of them are now from Iceland, but it's like taking our resident whales here and mix them with Alaskan residents and others. They have no natural home, that their family is their home, and basically SeaWorld has replaced their family with their personnel, and you know, they found that it works. They do require this contact and social fitness.
Mm-hmm. In this case, with
I thought there was a very interesting point about whether or not they intend to kill.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I don't. Well, it's very clear to me that they can have intent to not kill. We've seen many occasions where, in the case of transient killer whales preying upon seals and sea lions, mm-hmm. whales will start an attack and then decide not to. And the prey animal survives. We've seen it on TV with the, you know, putting a seal back on the beach in Patagonia after it mm-hmm. clearly has lost any chance of survival. So they can intend not to kill, which implies to me the reverse is also true, that they know when they're going to kill.
And if anybody would know, I guess you would. Ken Balcom with the Center for Whale Research in San Juan Island in Washington State. Ken, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Tim, our time is short. One of the ironies here is that, as you say, Tilikum, the killer whale that killed, is kind of a stud bull now in this industry. A lot of the offspring performing will be his offspring. What's his fate? What's going to happen, do you think, with this killer whale?
Tilikum will live the rest of his life at SeaWorld in a kind of limbo. I mean, they're not getting anywhere near him now. I mean, aside from the shows, the trainers do a lot of work hands-on with the killer whales, including Tilikum, before this. And now all the work that's done with him is done at a remove with extension poles and brushes. And so they can't release him. They can't put him in the shows, I don't think. I think he will just eventually die in isolation, which is very sad.
Well, we've learned a lot from this big piece of reporting of yours. Really a terrific story in the July issue of Outside Magazine. Listeners, you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow it right there in the magazine. It's The Killer in the Pool. Tim Zimmerman, great piece of work. Thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.